And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us. Great to be with you today. Packed program on Friday, just as we were finishing up the program, the state Republicans, those legislators in the state house that are Republican, including Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott, were calling for an independent evaluation of Vermont Health Connect. So I wanted to take some time this morning and discuss that. We'll discuss what are some of the issues with the Vermont Health Connect, what the Republicans are saying, what the administration is saying in response, and then we'll speak with Betsy Bishop, who's the president of the Vermont Chamber of Commerce, and we'll talk about issues that businesses may be having with Vermont Health Connect. And we'll ask you the question, what should we do with Vermont Health Connect? And then we'll turn our discussion to the legalization of marijuana, with legislation going through the Senate Appropriations Committee, and it was a very close vote. And it now goes to the floor of the full Senate. And we'll discuss the legalization aspect of marijuana with Rick Vyshek, who is the Vermont Homegrown Organization. They're supporting legalization. And then we'll check in with WCAX reporter Alex Apple, who is in South Carolina. And as all of you know, the South Carolina Democratic primary is coming up. We had the Republican primary on last Tuesday. Last Saturday. Now we have the Democratic primary that's coming up. But what was interesting yesterday is that VPR, Vermont Public Radio, released a poll. And there's some interesting tidbits that I wanted to discuss in that poll. And maybe we can find some time to look more fully at this later in the week. But I wanted to discuss a little bit of what is in that poll. And of course, if you want to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I'm not going to go through the whole poll, but there are some things that, and I've read polls, you know, most of my adult life. So, you know, there are some tidbits in here that I just wanted to point out. The first one is in the presidential race. And on the Republican side, Donald Trump is leading in this state 32.4% to his nearest challenger, which is Marco Rubio, at 16.9%. Even if you add it up, Marco Rubio, John Kasich, and Ted Cruz's numbers, you would come very close. You would be over Donald Trump's numbers, but you would be very close to his numbers, about 37% to 32.4%, if you added up those other three top contenders. So it looks like, from this poll, that Donald Trump's going to win the Vermont primary, which means that if he can win in Vermont, that's probably a good indication that he's on the path to win the nomination. And if you look at other polls, Donald Trump is leading in Michigan and Ohio over Kasich, who's the governor of Ohio. So it looks like a lot of people have made up their minds, if you look at the data in this poll, in terms of the Republican presidential race. And as I wrote a column, must be a month ago or so, that something appears to be going on in Vermont that we need to pay attention to. There seems to be a little bit of unrest that politicians need to pay attention to. If you look on the Democratic side, no surprise. Bernie Sanders just whomping Hillary Clinton with 83.1% of the vote in this poll. But if you look at the delegate count, and we keep looking at the delegate count because that's what's important to be nominated by your party, here's the lineup. In state contests so far, Hillary Clinton has 51 delegates. Sanders has 51. But here's where the superdelegates come in. This is according to CBS. Clinton has 551 superdelegates, and Bernie Sanders has 19 superdelegates for a total delegate count for Clinton of 502 to 70, even though they're tied in terms of the number of delegates that come from the primary results. One of the things that we saw in this poll that I've never seen before, I've never seen a poll result so low for a sitting governor three terms or two and a half terms into his governorship. The question is, do you approve or disapprove of the way Peter Shumlin is handling his job as governor of Vermont? 37% approved, 40% disapprove. Those are horrible numbers. And I'll talk about that in a minute because they will affect the governor's race on the Democratic side for other candidates who are running for governor. No surprise, Patrick Leahy, Peter Welch, the delegation is in good shape in terms of poll results. They have good poll numbers. One of the things that that I think is probably good news for Phil Scott so far, and I want to clarify that by saying so far, is that who do you hope to see elected Vermont's governor in 2016? Sue Minter was 12%, Matt Dunn was 15%, Phil Scott was 66%, Bruce Lisman was 3%. But there's a huge amount of undecided in this race. So you've got to be careful in terms of how you interpret it. Obviously, it's good for Phil Scott, but it's probably because Phil Scott has better name recognition than many of the other candidates. And that's probably what's driving the number. And you can buy, through advertisement and other things, name recognition. So I would be a little bit careful about how we interpret these numbers. So far, so good for Phil Scott, but there's a long way to go. And I suspect a lot of this is with reputation and name recognition. And a lot of people have not made up their mind yet in terms of what's going on. With Sue Minter, I think she's got to be a little bit careful. She has been aligning herself fairly closely with Governor Shumlin in many stuff. She defends the budgets that Governor Shumlin has put forth. She defends some of the policies that Governor Shumlin has put forth. And if you look at Governor Shumlin's numbers, those numbers are pretty low in terms of approve or disapproval of the job that Peter Shumlin is doing as governor of Vermont. So she's got to be a little bit careful on what's going on. Vermonters, according to this poll, support solar and wind energy, a little bit more solar than wind in terms of support. But by and large portions of the public support solar and wind. But, and there's a big but in this poll, but they are concerned in terms of the process of siting those facilities. And that's something I think policymakers have got to be aware of. In terms of gun support, do you support or oppose limiting where someone is allowed to carry a firearm? 58% support, 32% oppose. Do you support or oppose requiring a waiting period for gun sales? And 83% support, whereas 13% oppose. So those are some of the highlights of the poll that was done by Vermont Public Radio. If we get some time this week, we'll try to delve more fully into this poll. But what I want to do is change sort of our conversation to what happened on Friday. And what happened on Friday is that this press conference was going on just as we were going off the air. And the state's top Republican leaders said that we need an independent evaluation of Vermont Health Connect. And if for those that don't know what Vermont Health Connect is, it's the health exchange that if you do not, for those companies that are 50 employees and less, have to go in, and individuals that don't have health coverage need to go into this exchange. And as you know, it's been having some problems. It's been having some problems in reconciling with Blue Cross Blue Shield in terms of the amount of monies that Blue Cross Blue Shield is owed or not owed. And it has been having problems doing what are called change of circumstances. When you have a change in your coverage, whether it's a change of dependents or a change of spouse or a change, any sort of change, it is having problems recognizing that those changes. And at one time, it had huge backlogs in terms of what was going on with those changes. Those backlogs crept down, but they're starting to creep back up again. 6,500 changes needing to be made to customers' accounts. And Phil Scott, who's running for governor, said, "What we are doing isn't working. So I'm advocating that we have an assessment and we do so with somebody that is independent. It shouldn't be the administration that oversees it. So we will ask the Green Mountain Care Board to do it in a transparent way that we can get the right information back." And the one thing that the Republicans had said is we've got to figure out where we go with this. And by the way, this is not in terms of the assessment, now in terms of where we go with this in the future, but in terms of the assessment, this is something that a consultant told the House Health Care Committee is to stop doing what we're doing. Let's try to figure this out. Let's figure out what's the best course to go. And Blue Cross Blue Shield has talked about an assessment as well. Scott Coryell, who's the governor's spokesman, said, "We've been studying Vermont Health Connect for the past 3 years, and now we are just trying to make it work for people. The issue with an independent review is if the Republicans and if the Republicans and Lieutenant Governor have an idea for what to do, they should just come out and say it." Well, in all due respect to Scott Coryell, I think that what they're calling for is for somebody to look at this independently of the administration. So what I want to do now is turn to Betsy Bishop, who is the president of the Vermont Chamber of Commerce, not to talk about what the Republicans are doing or not doing and what they're calling for and what they're not calling for, but what's happening with business as they try to use what is called Vermont Health Connect or the Vermont Exchange. Let's go to Betsy, who's on the line. Betsy, good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Thank you for joining us, Betsy. What are some of the issues, or let me ask you this question. So what are the issues you're hearing from businesses around the state about Vermont Health Connect?
I think the issues for business and individuals are much the same. And I think one of the differences is about 3 years ago when this was put into place, there was a concept that both businesses and individuals are going to have to use the exchange to purchase their insurance. And those two populations were new populations. And over the last 2 years, we've been able to treat businesses a little bit differently than individuals. And what they employed was something called direct enrollment, which we were very glad for, we advocated for, and we're glad that businesses are able to do that. What direct enrollment does is it allows a business to call their insurer, either Blue Cross Blue Shield or MVP, and directly enroll their employees with the insurance company, essentially bypassing the Vermont Health Connect portal. Once they get to their insurer, they still have to buy the same products, but they're bypassing this very expensive portal that does not work. And so much of the frustration that you're hearing about Vermont Health Connect is coming from the individuals that don't have that workaround.
Betsy, there was a time, and many states have done this, where the exchange was just one option. And now, you know, you could go to your insurance company or you could go to the exchange. You could shop around. That wasn't an option when this was set up, was it?
No. It was an option that they chose not to do. We are the only state in the nation that has forced businesses and individuals to use this exchange, which still 3 years later is not working to the level that everybody wants it to work. So we put a mandate in Vermont that said there will be no private market for purchasing health insurance. There will only be the health insurance exchange. If you look at the documents of the Affordable Care Act and President Obama's statements around them when they were first instituted, this was hailed as an option for folks to purchase health insurance to increase access around the country. And that's exactly what all the other states did, is they had to have an exchange, but they didn't need to force everybody to use this one piece. If we had done it like the other states and had an option, and we had continued to have these problems that we have today, at least the private market would be working well, and you would have people who would be treated fairly in how they purchase insurance.
Betsy, what are some of the problems that are causing businesses to have to direct enroll? Are those some of the problems that I had mentioned?
Yes, I think those are all the same problems. I think change of circumstance is probably the biggest problem for anybody using Vermont Health Connect. But again, you can go directly to the insurer. I mean, who would have thought 3 years ago when, you know, if you think back 3 years ago when we really started this process, it was at the same time that the state was really putting their efforts behind a single-payer healthcare system. And the notion behind that is that, you know, we needed to move away from insurance companies. But now, you know, the business community is thankful that we have direct enrollment with insurance companies because we can call our insurer and get done what we need to get done. And the reason that that is a good thing is I know that insurance companies don't often have the best you know, reputation perhaps, but in this particular instance, they know what they're doing. They're staffed to be able to do that. They have the systems already in place to enroll people, to disenroll people, to do change of circumstances. That's what an insurance company does. And so there are benefits to using systems that work. And, you know, this was all at the time that this was employed when, you know, the Vermont Chamber was working to have this as an option. All of these pieces were brought to the attention of the legislature, but they chose not to go in this direction.
It's kind of ironic that an industry that is usually vilified is now the savior for small businesses here in Vermont.
And there's been a lot of discussion around, you know, creating a direct enrollment path for individuals as well, because it's working. So it's just, you know, as we've closed the private market in Vermont and had everybody go through the exchange, what has really happened is we're developing workarounds around a website. So once you find a way to enroll, you still only have a set group of products that are technically exchange products to buy. But we're figuring out ways to work around a very expensive web portal for enrollment. When this started for 20, 25 years, all the chambers of commerce in this state had banded together to create a very popular insurance program called Base Insurance. And all the chambers were involved in that. And we housed that enrollment system here at the Vermont Chamber of Commerce. I had five or six employees doing enrollment and disenrollment claims processing, premium processing, and negotiating with the insurance companies. We did all of that with six people here, and we did that for 17,000 lives. That's about half of the new lives that were brought in. The other half were individuals, were brought into Vermont Health Connect. So we have a really very clear understanding of the process, how it needs to happen, the systems that need to work. And we spent a good year, year and a half transferring those 17,000 lives to the state.
Betsy, the Republicans are calling for an independent review of Vermont Health Connect. Has your organization taken a position on that?
No, but I'd be glad to right now.
Go right ahead.
I think it's important that we get an independent review. Before today, before now, all of the information, all of the studying, all of the analysis comes from the administration to the legislature. And there are some of us that come from outside of those two bodies and give information as well. I think it's really important that we find an independent resource to give a fresh look at this to figure out what we're doing. You know, I heard the administration say, you know, if you have an idea, put it up. I think there's a lot of ideas that have been put up. I think there's a reluctance to change the path that we're on. And I would be reluctant to change the path that we're on until I knew what that alternative was. One very easy alternative that would potentially increase or relieve that pressure is we could lift the mandate that they put in place 3 years ago. If we no longer had a mandate for businesses and individuals to purchase insurance through the exchange, there might develop other options. Now, it's been 3 years, so many of those options have been closed off. So I can't say that all these options would come out. But usually where in a business model where there are problems, there are opportunities elsewhere. And perhaps lifting that mandate would create opportunities.
Betsy, this is me saying it. It's not you saying it. So I just want to make sure the audience knows. But, you know, last week we had a really good call in. I think her name was Ruth, and she called in and said, you know, this just isn't working for me. And the response from a legislator was, well, what's your idea? And my response to that is, wait a second, we elect you into to make these decisions. I've got a problem with this. Solve my problem. And that's something that I think was sort of disingenuous to the caller by saying, you know, what is your solution? And I think it's kind of disingenuous to say, well, what's your ideas? Because leadership means that you listen to ideas, that you take ideas, that you compile those ideas and you move forward, especially when something isn't working. And again, that's my opinion. It's not yours, but you can chime in if you'd like.
Well, I think, you know, part of leading, whether it's in government or in the private sector, is figuring out a path to success. And in this particular instance, everybody wants Vermont Health Connect to work well. I think I've heard folks say, you know, what should we do? Well, we should make Vermont Health Connect work. It's been 3 years. The level of frustration is getting higher, not lower. Do we have better plans today than we did 3 years ago? I would say they are about the same. Do we have better prices on those insurance plans than we did 3 years ago? No, we do not. Do we have better access to health care? Are more people getting covered? The answer to that is absolutely we are. And that's because there is a mandate at both the federal and the state level. But yes, there's better access. Has it been a cost-effective solution for the state to take over health insurance? No, I think that's borne out by the amount of money that we've spent on this. When those systems, as I had mentioned, were already in place in the private sector. So the question is, we have to have a health insurance exchange of sorts. We're ordered to do that by the federal law. But we need an exchange that either works or we need a pass through the private sector to allow people to purchase insurance without it being so difficult to do.
Betsy, one of the things that I have argued, Vermonters want three things in healthcare. They want quality, They want access and they want affordability. And I think by and large, Vermont does a pretty good job in terms of quality and access. Quality, we have quality healthcare institutions in this state. We have access, you know, 94 to 96% of Vermonters have access to health insurance coverage. But affordability is a huge issue. And just recently, the all-payer sort of waiver and system that we're talking about has come into the forefront as the savior for the affordability. Has your organization taken any position on the all-payer waiver?
I think we are where many Vermonters are on the all-payer waiver. We're studying it. We're understanding it. We still have lots of questions about it. The concept is a good concept, but it's also a very big idea. And right now, I feel like Vermonters, at least when I go out and talk to Vermonters, they're a little bit skittish of the government taking on really big ideas in healthcare right now. We haven't proven our success in doing that. When you think about an all-payer waiver, an all-payer model, if you will, some of the ideas there are certainly changing how we pay for healthcare from fee-for-service to outcome-based. I think very few people would disagree with that. That is a good concept to do that. Whether or not we get the right amount of money from the federal government that sets the trend rate, something that we can live with, have we proven in Vermont that we can bring down the rate of healthcare costs? I don't think we have. And I think you mentioned sort of the big three things in healthcare: quality, access, and affordability. And you're absolutely right. I've been working in the State House on healthcare for 20 years. I hate to say that out loud. It's been that long. And we have focused, all of those 20 years, we have focused on making sure that we have access. And you can see with focus and attention, we have gotten that up to about 97%. Quality, we have focused on quality so that people accessing our healthcare services have really good quality. And I think you look around the state and we do have that. But affordability has always been, for those 20 years, has always been where the crunch is. And I think it's past due that we spend a little time focusing on the affordability equation of healthcare and start to bring that into play.
We've been speaking with Betsy Bishop, who's the president of the Vermont Chamber of Commerce. Thank you so much, Betsy, for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you, Mike, for having me.
Well, thank you. And coming up, it's your phone calls. What should we do with Vermont Health Connect? This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. What we're talking about is Vermont Health Connect. What should we do with that? What direction should we go? Obviously, it's a $200 million investment that the state made into Vermont Health Connect, and it isn't working. And it cost, over the last few years, probably another $100 million in operating costs. So what should we do with Vermont Health Connect? There still are problems with the Vermont Health Connect. It has a problem reconciling with the insurers. There is a problem with the reconciliation with the insurers, with Blue Cross Blue Shield in particular, one of the bigger insurers in this state. There's also problems, and this has been persistent problems, with what are called change of circumstances. When you have a change in your circumstance, trying to get that on your policy, trying to get add people, trying to take off people, those sort of things, there's been problems. The Republicans had called last Friday for an independent review outside of the administration of the Vermont Health Connect. And one of the things that they aren't the only ones. There was a consultant that was informing legislators that maybe we should pause do an evaluation and figure out what is the best way of going. What's your thoughts? Give me a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Tom in Waterbury. Tom, you're on open.
Yeah, good morning, Mike. I have a couple drinks. I've always thought all along it was kind of like a no-brainer. Why don't we just let Blue Cross run it? I mean, they're good at their job. The only thing I would say is put in some kind of a review thing where people could go if they have a problem with a decision that's not, you know what I mean, a separate board, mm-hmm. like something to do with the state if you have a complaint, you know, as far as they wouldn't pay for this or that, rather than going to them. My other thought is who is the department in the state or the person that keeps getting these systems that are total failures, and are we taking like the lowest bid on this stuff? Is that why we're ending up like this? And my third thing, it was actually what you were talking about earlier, so it's not your health care, but I didn't know if you happened to hear that little snippet thing there. Lindsey Graham has come out and said that if a certain Republican won the nomination, that maybe the Republicans should think about voting, putting a Democrat in the White House this coming election, and I'll just hang up and listen.
Hey, Tom, thank you very much for your call. One of the things that Betsy Bishop said, and goes right along to what you had said, Tom, is that most states, when they were setting up their exchanges, used the exchange as one option. So you could keep your insurer if that was the best option for you. So you had multiple options that you could go to. And one of the things that I think that most states have found that sort of worked for them. The other thing, you talk about lowest bids. That's a really good question. How is the bid process working for us in this state, on particularly on IT projects? I know that the Agency of Human Services just canceled one of their huge IT processes, IT projects, trying to think maybe we got to rethink this bidding process and going out in huge chunks, and it was hundreds of millions of dollars in IT costs were something that is interesting. And as far as Lindsey Graham, you know, he's got his own opinion. You know, the Republican Party is probably going to nominate Donald Trump as it stands right now and as the polls are. Now, you know, these things can shift, but they are going to it looks like he's got a clear path to the nomination right now. So what we're discussing this morning is, what would you do with Vermont Health Connect? Let's go to Forbes. Forbes, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great, thank you.
As a citizen sitting back here, all of us have been through a nightmare over this thing. It's the biggest can of worms the state will probably ever see. You know, getting back to the concept, that's fine. But then we get into the program, and along comes a fellow named Gruber, who tells me that my intelligence is exactly what they need to be able to put this program through. I really took inference with that. But all the way along, it's been, you couldn't get the information you needed. Phil Scott's been screaming for a year about this. And, of course, he's a minority at that particular time. Hopefully not in the future, but I think an independent review would be really in order. My question is that a legislative responsibility? There's some question of that as to whether Green Mountain Board could take on that exercise and whether they have the expertise to do it. They could get, obviously, outside or someone that could review it, and they control the functions of it. But it surely would put the Green Mountain Board on notice, and we would see whether they really were independent and acting in the best interest of the citizens.
Interesting concept for just to sort of play this out a little bit. Obviously, it would either have to be the legislature or the administration calling for an independent review, and I'm not sure what mechanism is probably at this point is going to be a legislative. As I read the administration's quotes, they're not too excited about an independent review right at the moment. And I could understand why they're not that excited about an independent review, but it probably would have to come from the legislature at this moment in time. Whether the Green Mountain Care Board is the appropriate mechanism or not, who knows? But someone should be in charge of this independent review, and that seems like, you know, one of the aspects of where it should go, given the fact that they do everything, they look at everything with healthcare. So independent outside of the administration, because the administration is providing all the information right now. I think it helps the administration. I think it helps the legislature. I think it reassures Vermonters. So what we're talking about this morning is, what do you think we should do with Vermont Health Connect? It's obviously had its problems. We've invested a ton of money into it. What do you think we should do? Let's go to Paul in Moncton. Paul, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. I've been listening to this debate now for several years, both at the state level and the federal level, and I think the easy answer is staring us in the face, and it's just a simple tearing down of what we currently have now and rebuilding something much easier to deal with. And my suggestion is this. First of all, we cover all children. I don't think any child should ever have to go without because of anything that happened, you know, basically because of the parents or lack thereof. So all children get covered, period. Whether it's the 1821, you know, we can talk about that. From that point on, the government would only cover what I'm calling catastrophic insurance. That is based upon your finances. If you're making $1 million a year, you've got $5 million in investments, you own your house, guess what? You're paying in probably no more than a guy or a couple of four with two kids that's making $100,000, $125,000 a year. But the difference is, they probably won't have a deductible. Your deductible is going to be so high, you're still going to be paying out of pocket. But where that person gets to save money is then we allow that person to buy supplemental insurance without guaranteed issue, without community rating, so that if they're taking care of themselves, they can get insurance to cover the deductible and save money at that level. The insurance would also, you know, the plan would also cover all basic, preventative care. Everybody should be able to go for a physical. Everybody should have an eye visit. Everybody should have two dental cleanings a year and have their teeth checked. And I think by making this catastrophic that the government covers, I think we can simplify some of the process and take some of the cost out of it that we're currently, you know, are in place now, because what we're really doing is providing a lot of subsidized insurance for people who may not be taking care of themselves by choice. And money is still being wasted and it's still not being handled properly. And that's kind of been what I've been looking at. And everybody I've talked to, both conservative and liberal, have said that's not a bad idea.
Hey, Paul, thank you for the idea. You know, that's what we need. We need more Vermonters talking about different ideas, and whether that's one of them or not, you know, at least it's an idea out there. You know, the other thing that we talked about is just simply letting people go to an insurance company, whether it's individual or business. Businesses are right now because the exchange, obviously, Vermont Health Connect is not working for them. So the change of circumstances situation, the reconciliation, all those sort of things aren't working, so businesses are allowed to go what is called direct enrollment right to an insurance company. You know, one of the easiest ways probably is to allow that for individuals and businesses and make the exchange an option. But that's something that an independent review probably would evaluate, or it would evaluate maybe there's other exchanges that we can buddy up with. Maybe it's the federal exchange. Maybe it's something like Hawaii with a hybrid sort of system. But certainly, I don't understand the resistance to an independent review, but you may have a different opinion. Let's go to Fred in Newberry. Fred, what do you think we should be doing with Vermont Health Connect?
I had just basically a comment. I mean, this healthcare business is compound complex problems, you know what I mean? Montpelier is so presumptuous that it can run healthcare and it can't even run the state. I mean, how much money does the federal government have to pump in the state to keep it above board?
Mm-hmm. So you would think that, what would we do? Would we look at an independent evaluation, an independent sort of assessment? What should we do at this point? Because we have it. What should we do?
Just throw it away, and then have the people buy health care the best way they can buy health care. I mean, most states you can't go to another state to buy health care. You have a problem doing that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just a complicated problem. I mean, why would Montpelier think they could run health care? That's what puzzles me.
Fred, thank you very much for the phone call. Fred thinks that we should get out of the somewhat. I don't think he's saying that, you know, but Montpelier has not done a good job running health care. We'll be back with your phone calls. Be interested in what you think. What should we do with Vermont Health Connect? This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. What we're discussing this morning, what should we do with Vermont Health Connect? It's been a problem since its inception in terms of getting it operational. It continues to be a problem to continue operation. It has problems dealing with change of circumstances. When you change your circumstances with your insurance, it has problems recognizing that. There's a backlog. We've spent $200 million setting up this exchange. We've spent almost $100 million in terms of operational costs with this exchange. What should we do with Vermont Health Connect? The number, if you've got an opinion, call us, is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. The Republicans are calling in the State House, are calling for an independent evaluation, and that independent evaluation, that independent study, will look at what we should do with our Vermont Health Connect. And it's been having problems. It's been having problems since the inception, big backlogs in terms of change of circumstances, and it can't reconcile with the insurers or not reconcile properly. So what should we do? Should we call for an independent investigation? Should we do something different in terms of what you think we should do with Vermont Health Connect? By the way, how is Vermont Health Connect working for you? If you've had an experience with Vermont Health Connect, certainly would like to hear from you. And it had so many problems that businesses have been allowed to direct enroll, meaning they can go right to the insurers. And Vermont is only a handful, and Betsy Bishop said the only state, that has this opportunity where you have to, employers 50 or less, and individuals have to go into the exchange. Many states set up their exchanges so that it was one option that you can do. So what would you do? What do you think you should do with Vermont Health Connect? Phil Scott says we need an independent investigation, an independent assessment. He said what we're doing isn't working. So I'm advocating that we have the assessment and we do so with somebody that is independent. It shouldn't be the administration that oversees this. We should ask the Green Mountain Care Board to do it in a transparent way that we can get the right information back. Scott Coriel said if people are thinking that before Vermont Health Connect insurance went smoothly and well for people, then they're mistaken. And he said also, we've been studying VHC, which is Vermont Health Connect, for the past 3 years, and now we are just trying to make it work for people. What do you think? What do you think we should do with Vermont Health Connect? We still have about 5 minutes, so give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. I would suspect some of the numbers that I talked about with Governor Shumlin being so low in the polls has something to do with this and the implementation of Vermont Health Connect. So give us a call if you've got an opinion. What we should do with Vermont Health Connect? Let's go to Bob in Plainsfield. Bob, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
The short answer is cut your loss and go to a federal exchange.
And what the administration will say, Bob, is that that cost a lot of money in order to do that. $25 million in IT costs, and then maybe $5 to $10 million in in operational costs. What do you say to them?
Now, let me see. They've already spent $200 million on something that doesn't work. And when you consider the maintenance fees for that system, once again, cut your loss and go to the federal exchange. But I got a question for you, Mike, if you don't mind.
Go right ahead, Bob.
I'm going to say, do other states limit health care choice to the extent Vermont does, where we primarily have Blue Cross and the other one?
I think most states, particularly bigger states, have more companies in their states. I mean, Aetna was here for quite a while. I think it was Aetna, was here for quite a while. Probably there's more choices in other states. I don't know, you know, other states do community rating. I don't know how many other states do community rating, but certainly there are other, particularly bigger states, have more health care choices than...
You take a look at it. Didn't the Obamacare sort of level the field in terms of community rating and issues related to that? So if that is the case, and insurance companies can't cherry-pick from state to state, why don't they just open up the floodgates and encourage choice, more choice?
You know, Bob, I've heard that more and more, and thank you very much for that suggestion. But I've heard more and more of, how do you get across, what about state lines? I mean, we buy everything. We buy stuff now from Amazon, you know, all over the place. So what about health insurance? Can we do that? And part of the problem is going to be, can those sort of health plans that are in other states meet the requirements of the state? And the different states have different requirements. And certainly it's a very, very interesting question. And once, at one time, when the state looked at it, and no, there were just varying aspects that some of those health plans just wouldn't qualify in Vermont. But Bob raises a good point. Does Obamacare level the playing field to allow this sort of state-to-state purchase happen? And that would be a very, very interesting concept. And Bob, thank you so much for that phone call, because that was an interesting sort of concept. One thing I just wanted to alert you for tomorrow is that I am, maybe it's just me, but I am really interested in this FBI-Apple sort of showdown. And tomorrow I'm going to bring in some lawyers, and we're going to talk about this, including Alan Gilbert from the ACLU and some others, to talk about this showdown between Apple and the FBI. And I was just wondering if, I hope you were as interested as I am. And if we get time tomorrow, maybe we can go over more in depth some of the poll results that we saw coming from the VPR. But the big upshot that I'm seeing in that poll results, Donald Trump is probably going to win Vermont. Phil Scott is way up, but we got to be careful in reading too much into those poll results for Phil Scott, because there is a long way to go. If one of the things that I just wanted to make sure that you're aware of is that you can always go to our podcast and listen to this show. If you can't hear all of it because you're in and out of your car, or if you have other things to do, you can go onto our website at wdevradio.com and click on the podcast and listen to the Open Mic Show. This is Open Mic on WDEV Radio News, AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont. 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And of course, as I said, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for joining us in the second half of our program. We usually at this time, and we will continue at this time, in the program, we turn our attention to national issues and talk with our friends and colleagues at Talk Media News. And on the phone line this morning is Bob Ney. Bob, good morning.
Yes, and we shall continue also.
Hey, one of the things that you may not be aware of, but there's a poll in Vermont by Vermont Public Radio that's done by the Castleton Institute, which is a mm-hmm. university here in Vermont. One of the things that surprised me in this poll, and I'll get to the question that I'm going to ask you, just bear with me here, is that Donald Trump on the Republican side is leading 32.4% to Marco Rubio, who is 16.9%, John Kasich, who is 10%, and Ted Cruz, who has 10.5%. Even if you added all of those up and assumed that if there was one candidate, it'd be 37%, which you can't assume, that means Donald Trump is probably going to win Vermont. And if Donald Trump is winning Vermont and he's leading in Michigan and in Ohio over Kasich, what stops him from getting the nomination? Bob, are you there? Well, we seem to have lost Bob Ney. Hopefully he'll call right back in. But that is my question. What happens if Donald Trump wins Vermont and he wins Super Tuesday? Can he be stopped, and will he be the Republican nomination? So we've lost Bob. He's calling back as we speak. And hopefully he heard the question, or maybe he didn't hear the question. But the question is, if Donald Trump is winning Vermont with 32.9%, what stops him? And he's winning in the polls, or he's leading in the polls in Michigan and Ohio over Kasich. What stops him from the nomination? Bob, are you there?
Yes. I don't know what happened. I lost you. Sorry.
No problem.
Look, you know, Vermont, I love Vermont. It's independent, it's feisty, you know, and we look towards New Hampshire and Vermont and what's going on there. And I expected Trump would, you know, really do well there. But we're looking at Nevada and then the Ohio numbers, you know, my home state. But I think Trump runs the table. But let me put a caveat here. I'm not sure the way the system is with portions and some states winner takes all. If Rubio and Cruz, and let's say Kasich, hang in there and they don't drop out, Donald Trump may go into the convention ahead, but he may not have enough delegates, so it has to go a couple of rounds of vote calling.
Bob, you've been in the system.
Yes.
You're bound by the first round. Are you bound by the second and third round?
Well, there's the other thing, too. Each state's different. I was a delegate at large to Kansas City when Ford and Reagan went at each other. And as an at-large delegate way back then, I think I was 20 years old or so, I was ethically bound, not legally bound. So, you know, there's states that have all kinds of different systems. But there's a lot of free cards, I think, as I understand it, after a first round of the convention or second, there's a lot of free agents, I'll call them, plus a lot of deal cutting. Somebody's got to give.
Mm-hmm. On the Democratic side in Vermont, this is going to be no surprise to you. Bernie Sanders is winning with 83.1% of the vote. But if you look at the delegate count right now, and I took this off CBS's website, in terms of what's been won at the state level, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, they're tied 51-51. But if you look at the superdelegates, which is Clinton 451 to Sanders 19.
Right.
The total is 502 to 70. Boy, there's a difference here.
Well, yes, but you know, I have friends on the Democratic side who say to me, why doesn't Bernie drop out? And I say, why should he? Because even though the system, I'm not going to say rigged, okay, but the system is fixed towards a certain way. Each party is different. And the Democratic side, the system is fixed with this whole superdelegate thing where Bernie Sanders can walk out of New Hampshire winning but doesn't have as many delegates. Now, having said that, I honestly think this is way beyond Bernie Sanders becoming president, as much as Bernie Sanders has millions of followers and he has an issue. You know, he cares about issues. So I don't see Bernie Sanders dropping out. I don't care what the delegate count is.
Will we see a third party entry into this presidential race? If it is, it's got to start soon.
Well, if it's, you know, my friends, some of them say, well, Bloomberg, and I think they're smoking something and inhaling at the same time.
We're going to be talking about that next, Bob, with our next guest, but go ahead.
I don't believe Bloomberg is viable, but so I don't see anybody beyond Bloomberg.
And you need a lot of money. You need a lot of personal money in order to.
Yeah, and he's got money. I just don't see viability. I really don't.
One of the things that we saw over the weekend is that Cruz fired his spokesperson, and that
right.
was because they had put out a message that Rubio was trashing the Bible, and actually he was saying just the opposite.
Well, to make matters worse, he made a statement to Ted Cruz's father, was sitting there, and it wasn't what the campaign said it was. I think it's even worse. Cruz's dad was sitting there and knows they didn't say that. It just became really ugly. They had to correct that. Somebody had to be fired. But this has been a pattern with Cruz, and mistakes happen in campaigns. It's a pattern, though. You can go back to, you know, Iowa. You can go back to the Ben Carson statement. You can go back to the mailer they put out. You know, then, of course, Trump calls him a liar. Rubio calls him a liar. And then guess what? This happens. So I think Cruz better really make sure he gets on track. But even worse than that, I watched Cruz for 30 minutes at his own press conference talk about Donald Trump. I mean, really, please.
Ben Carson, why is he still in it?
Well, now that's another interesting one. My take on Carson is this. You know, people say, why is Santorum still in this? Why is Huckabee still in this? Ben Carson's one of those guys you kind of look at him and go, well, it's okay. He's still in it. You know, he has some issues. People don't get as offended for some reason, Ben Carson hanging in there. I just think he's hanging in there, you know, to talk about issues, because he's technically done. Let's face it. You know.
Let's turn to overseas. Syria's a mess. What is Bob Kerry, not Bob Kerry, what is John Kerry? You can tell I'm an ex-Navy SEAL with mentioning Bob Kerry. What's John Kerry doing in Syria?
Look, we have this Russian-American ceasefire, but look, Russia's going to still go after ISIS and be allowed to, and we're still going to go after ISIS. And frankly, the way that is over there, who knows who is on what side? So you got a technical ceasefire against the anti-Assad people, but let's face it, a lot of collateral damage, and it's a technical ceasefire, but they're still going to go at anti-Assad people. That's what Russia's going to do.
The nomination for Supreme Court Justice seems to be headed for a battle. What's your take on it?
Well, Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, made the biggest political blunder a human being could make. He started out saying, well, Mr. President, don't appoint. Well, come on, don't ask the president to do that. Number two, he said, well, we're not going to approve anybody. Then all of a sudden, guess what? I can start with Kelly Ayotte. I can start with Rob Portman of Ohio, Senator Kirk. From the Midwest, they're all in a little bit of a problem of saying no vote. So I think they're going to have hearings. This thing's just going to inch into where they're going to have a vote probably. McConnell really set the stage, I think, in the wrong direction on this thing. Now, there's a lot of hypocrisy all over the place. They're digging up tapes, you know, Joe Biden 26 years ago. And
yeah, it depends who's in power. That
gotcha.
Depends of where you sit. It seems like you can find somebody that was advocating, no, we shouldn't do it in the election year when a Republican is in power and the Democrats mm-hmm. are in power in the Senate, and you can vice versa here. So it's
that's right.
It's interesting. But it does put some Republicans in a bind. For example, Kelly Ayotte is up against Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire, and that's going to be what many think are going to be a close race. It's going to be a close race.
Right, and Rob Portman of Ohio got off the diving board. We're not going to do this and that. And all of a sudden, it's like, well, maybe we ought to do this and that. So they got to be careful of saying, you know, we're going to turn down anybody you send. Wait till the president sends them, then find a reason to turn them down, frankly.
Bob, as always, a lot to talk about, and I thank you very much. That's Bob
Nay
from Talk Media News. Up next, we'll talk about legalizing marijuana. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. There's been a lot of discussion lately about the legalization of marijuana, and you've probably read in the news this morning that legislation is going through the Senate. It just passed the Senate Appropriations Committee on a very close vote, 4-3. Some of those members have said they won't vote for it on the floor of the House, but voted for it at least to get it to the floor of the House. And so this discussion that we're going to have in the next few minutes is pertinent because there is so much talk about legalizing marijuana. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. On the line this morning is Rick Veach, who is with the Vermont Homegrown organization. They obviously are supporting legalization. Good morning, Rick. How are you?
Good morning. We're supporting legalization, but not the current bill.
Okay.
That's going up before the Senate.
Well, let me sort of back up, and I can probably tell you, I probably can surmise why you're not supporting the current bill, but let's back up. Why should we legalize marijuana in this state?
Well, because prohibition has obviously failed. A lot of people in the state admit to being users. I think the number the RAND report estimated was 80,000 Vermonters admit that they use marijuana regularly. They estimated 55,000 pounds of marijuana being consumed in the state every year. And that means that a large percentage of that is grown in Vermont by Vermonters under sort of draconian penalties, and that income, all the money from that, is currently floating around in the alternative so-called black market.
So would we eliminate the black market if we legalized marijuana?
Depends how you legalize marijuana. The current bill creates a state-regulated monopoly, and which will offer 15 licenses to large-scale growers and write off everybody else in the state as criminals who might want to cultivate. The way to legalize it is to bring these home growers out into the light, let them cultivate marijuana for their personal and medicinal use, and if they wish to cultivate artisanal marijuana, create a regulatory system that can make that happen. It's the kind of thing that will float everybody's boat in the state. It'll help everybody rather than a few people lucky enough to get the licenses.
So let me also back this up a little bit more, this bus a little bit more. Mm-hmm. You are supportive of legalizing marijuana, but you don't like the current bill because it prohibits home growers. Is that correct?
It prohibits home growers, and it funds the state police. They will get 26 new troopers in the next 2 years. They will get $1.5 million out of the general fund right off the top. They will get 25% of all revenue for the sale and taxation of marijuana, and they will get 50% of all seizures. So we're looking at an unprecedented expansion of our police presence to protect this monopoly market.
And so what would you, if you had your druthers with, did you like the original White Benning bill that went into the legislature before it was changed to prohibit homegrown?
Very much so. In fact, our group was instrumental in testifying before Senator White's committee, and they actually listened to us. It was really inspiring how much time they spent and how our arguments were accepted and actually became part of the bill. What was kind of odd was as the bill went into judiciary, Senator Sears famously quoted that he was drawing a line in the sand over homegrown and stripped that all out and added all the extra earmarked money for the state police. Governor Shumlin got right on board, and Jeanette White and Joe Benning signed off on it.
We're speaking with Rick Veach, who's with the Vermont Homegrown organization. And one of the things that people will say, Rick, is that one of the reasons you said, you know, prohibition hasn't worked with marijuana. There's an underground market that we don't control, certainly don't regulate. So if you bring this out in the open, it will be better for Vermont because of the number of people that use marijuana in this state. But couldn't you say the same about heroin? It's prohibited. There's a black market. There's many people that use it. And if we legalize it and bring it out in the open, wouldn't that help our heroin situation? What's your response to that?
I think that's a red herring. You know, heroin and marijuana are two different things. You know, marijuana is a plant that was given to us by nature that for some reason has, you know, for political purposes, 100 years ago was prohibited. You know, heroin is a manufactured product from the opium poppy, and it is clinically highly addictive to the human body, where marijuana isn't. So I think one of the problems everyone's dealing with here is all these years of prohibition have filled everybody's brains with propaganda that is false. And to equate it with heroin, it's just a red herring.
One of the things that came out in the VPR poll was, and I don't have it sitting in front of me, but about over 50% of Vermonters support legalization, 30% don't. It breaks down demographically where the older you are, the less supportive you are. We won't eliminate the black market, will we, with legalizing marijuana?
Not with this bill, no. Because, you know, Vermonters have been doing the Robin Hood thing forever, and they're just going to continue to be out there in Sherwood Forest, you know, beating the sheriff of Nottingham. It's just going to continue to happen. So the only way to solve the so-called black market problem is to recognize that it's our friends and neighbors all in every corner of Vermont who are doing this, and to use all that talent and all that energy and our climate and our land to boost the economy of Vermont from the bottom up.
Rick, we're speaking with Rick Veach, who's with the Vermont Homegrown Organization. Am I getting that right? Is it an organization? You're with an organization that's called Vermont Homegrown, right?
Well, we're just a citizens group. We don't solicit money, and we don't have a any kind of, you know, website other than our Facebook page. This is a group of medical marijuana patients who recognized early on that the biggest stakeholders in legalization in Vermont were the home cultivators. These home cultivators can't come forward because they're considered criminals right now. As medical marijuana patients, we realize that, hey, we can talk about this. We can bring this out into the light.
So your biggest problem with the bill, that as it's going through, it commercializes marijuana and leaves the homegrown community out of this. Is that correct?
Yes, it creates a state-controlled monopoly with very few expensive licenses that will allow industrial-sized grows. And everybody else is threatened with jail.
But what how do you control? You've got to agree that there's got to be some control over this. How do you control it if everybody's allowed to home grow it?
Well, not everybody will home grow it, but the people who want to should be able to. It's just a plant. It's not, you know, a horrible drug. It's not some evil thing. It's just a plant that God gave us. So let people grow it. And also recognize that the potential of Vermont to be sort of like, you know, the Napa Valley of wine in New England for marijuana, allow that to happen. It'll be good for everybody. It'll make the state more money than they ever would with the current scheme.
Rick, there was a delegation that went to Colorado. It was a bunch of people that went to Colorado, and they came back and they said the one thing that they got from Colorado was don't rush this legislation. Do you, why the rush in getting this done this year?
Well, I think it was originally the governor planned to put all his chips behind single-payer health. That's what we were told when we were asking about it. And as soon as the single-payer thing blew up in his face, all of a sudden it was, you know, the rush for marijuana. I have to say, though, that I heard Secretary Flynn's testimony after he got back in front of Janet White's committee, and he said, hey, we can do this. The sky didn't fall out there. It works. This can work in Vermont if we do it right.
One of the things that's not in the bill is edibles. Would you support edibles as well?
I'm not really a big supporter of edibles. I think there's a lot of potential for them to be misused. I know that on the medical side of things, a lot of people can't smoke the stuff. So if they're able to eat it, it has a much better effect. So that's all got to be studied. And I think Jeanette White's original bill, which sort of like said, let's just do the legalization first, and then we'll study the edible thing, is probably the correct way to go.
We're speaking with Rick Veach, who's the from the Vermont Homegrown Organization, and that is actually a homegrown organization, sort of a grassroots no pun intended, sort of a grassroots organization. If you wish to join our conversation, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Peter in Waitsfield. Peter, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. I think we need to treat marijuana like alcohol, tax it, regulate it, but people can brew beer for themselves if they want to. They can make their own wine if they want to, legally within a certain quantity. And the same thing should apply to marijuana. We need to, demythologize marijuana as being some kind of dangerous drug. It's arguably safer than alcohol. And when it comes to this question of, well, if we legalize marijuana, why don't we legalize heroin? It's not the question. Actually, there's a very good case to be made for treating all substances in a medical sense as a health issue, not as a criminal justice issue. And I am embarrassed that Vermont has been as anemic as it has in marijuana law reform. The thing is this idea of treating something as illegal, whether or not it's dangerous, and that that's going to somehow make the problem go away. It doesn't. It creates a whole host of other problems. And, in European countries, they have treated heroin as a health issue. They've even prescribed injectable heroin to heroin addicts. And guess what happened? Not only did property crime go down, but these addicts were able to actually lead productive lives when they no longer had to go chase their fix. So,
thanks, Peter. Thanks for the phone call. Rick, any response to Peter's sort of opinion on this?
Well, except for the, going off on the heroin bit, I agree with him. Again, I don't think we should mix apples and oranges here. This is marijuana. It's a very simple, beneficial plant. It's medicinally beneficial. They're finding out the most amazing things about it right now. Anybody who's interested in that should Google marijuana and cancer cure. You might be really surprised at what this plant is doing right now.
Rick, how do you respond? Because I think you would acknowledge that probably not everyone, but most of law enforcement is probably against this. A lot of drug counselors are against legalization. Perhaps there's some for. How do you respond to people who are against this? What do you say to people who are against it?
I don't really respond to the arguments on public health and safety. I think, again, those are kind of like straw man arguments. The real problem with this bill is that it takes this resource out of the community. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars coming out of all corners of the state of Vermont and going into the hands of a very small cadre of people who get these licenses. To put it in perspective, the Rand Corporation estimated $225 million black market in Vermont. Now, the market for maple syrup is $50 million. The market for craft beer is $100 million. So marijuana dwarfs both of those. And they're going to take that out of the community. That's what this bill, as written, as on the floor, going onto the floor today, does. It's a transfer of wealth from the lower to the hands of a small group. And the argument is kind of hidden and not even discussed because they're so easily able to bring up these safety things that are just straw men. They're not real.
And where this went awry with you is when the Senate basically changed this and made this into the only people that could distribute or grow this was a commercial operation and not homegrown. Am I getting that right?
That was Senator Sears and the Judiciary Committee. But if you go on to Vermont Digger today, there's a terrific article about the governor's invisible hand. And having been part of this process intimately from the beginning, I think we can see that we were led along by Jeanette's bill and that they planned all along to work this deal with Sears and to grab control of this natural resource and this wealth for their cronies.
Let's go to Rich in East Montpelier. Rich, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I would just like to point out I do agree with Rick. If you look into the papers last fall, cannabis was up for legalization in Ohio, and they turned it down. The voters turned it down because it was going to be given to the cultivation privileges of seven individual companies to run the whole thing. And that's what Vermont's trying to do, and that's what's going to destroy it.
Thanks, Rich. Thanks for the phone call. Let's go to Eli in Burlington. Eli, you're on open mic.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking the call. I agree with Rick on most of what he said, and I think Vermont Homegrown's done a really impressive job of organizing. I read on a website called Vermont the Wanted. I've been at a lot of these same meetings with them and share their frustration and seeing sort of how this process has unfolded. You know, I don't see the issue being as much as it's a monopoly and crony capitalism, as much as it's centralized because people are so afraid. And I think that's one thing that's really hard for advocates, is to show people in Vermont that the sky will not fall here if we do have something. And, you know, even the terminology, when people think about homegrown, imagining somebody having weed at a farm stand, which I think a lot of us wouldn't be afraid of, but realize that's a far stretch from reality that we have now. You know, I think the actual, we should be talking about it decentralized. You know, I think for testing reasons and in the beginning for enforcement to get an idea of what's out there, you can understand why they want to have fewer places to try to inspect and figure out. But the licensing fee, it should be said, I think it's $15,000 non-refundable for the smallest cultivation permit. So I think even reshaping that, if they lower the application fee, the non-refundable fee, to something like $500 or even $100, and then once you get the license, if you're approved, then you pay the huge fee to actually get to play in a really lucrative business. The idea being that people who do have these skills, the underground growers, would actually get a chance to come out of the woods and I think all they're looking for is really an equal playing field. You know, so I support that, and I do think that there's a lot of skill and expertise that will help make for a healthier overall cannabis industry in Vermont.
Thanks, Eli. Rick, what do you think about Eli's suggestion that we sort of lower the cost of getting into the game?
I think that's, you know, a good first step, but we also got to have more licenses available. It can't just be 15 licenses. That, you know, that'll be subject to political favoritism. It's got to be unlimited. Anybody who wants to get in, yes, you pay your fee and you farm and you cultivate cannabis and you have access to markets that the state will be setting up, possibly through co-ops. Personally, I too would love to see it available in farmers markets, but I understand that we're quite a bit ways, you know, from that. But a level playing field, yeah. Let the little guy win.
Rick, I haven't followed the bill completely through when it was introduced and when it sort of came out of the Senate. I have been paying attention after it came out of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate. But wouldn't one of the arguments be that you sort of have to control this in some way? Because if you don't control it and you give it to anybody that's a homegrown, what's to prevent it sort of from being a nuisance more so than alcohol?
Well, I just went out and visited California, where pretty much anybody can get marijuana under their lax medical thing. And it was no problem anywhere. You know, it was like invisible. People weren't standing around smoking marijuana. People weren't doing it at dinner. It wasn't. It was just like, it's old hat now. And I think a lot of these questions that arise are fear-based questions that have been placed in everybody's minds by decades of ridiculous propaganda. And we all got to kind of free our minds from that and look at the reality of it, which is a plant that has pleasant, you know, it feels good to do it, and it also has medicinal properties, and anyone can grow it in their home. It makes a lot of sense that way.
Let's go to a caller it looks like on a cell phone, so if you're on open mic, good morning.
Yes, hello?
You're on.
Oh, hi. Yes, this is Keith from Thetford, Vermont.
Hey, Keith.
I wanted to take a step back and talk more about the licenses, if I could.
Go right ahead, sir.
I believe that we have an opportunity in the state of Vermont to help distribute the economic prosperity that will be brought about by creating a new business, a whole new industry here in the state, and provide some financial relief to some, not only the small farmers in our state, but also the people that live away from the population centers, and don't necessarily have access to the industry or the jobs that some of the other people may have in the state. I believe that the state is unfortunately moving away from the Vermont way in the way that they've written the bill. Artisanal products that are created in the state that have helped really push forward this state and the quality of the products that are made here is only being shot down and really kind of denigrated by the way this bill is being presented. You cannot create an artisanal product when you only have a certain amount of people growing it on a very large industrial scale. I also believe that the licensing fee is, although I understand you have to pay for the oversight of the licensees, I believe that you're making it financially, you're pushing it too far for the average Vermonter to be able to get involved in a business that could very well subsidize their personal incomes and allow them to then take that extra money and spend it within our communities.
Thanks, Keith. Thanks for the phone call. Rick, I'm going to give you the last word on this, but I think if I'm summarizing it right, you're not particularly supportive of the bill that's going through the Senate because it opens up the door for commercialization of marijuana but prohibits homegrown. Have I got that right?
Well, I go a little stronger, and I'd say it creates a government-regulated monopoly that will be in the hands of a few and will transfer $225 million of wealth out of our local communities into the hands of this few. The bill is on the floor of the Senate today. People should be aware of what the language of it as it changes, and if it continues to go through as it is written now, they should get a hold of their senators and say, no way.
We've been speaking with Rick Vetch, who's he was one of the co-founders of the Vermont Home Growers organization, and that's a sort of a grassroots sort of an organization that gets together and trying to mold legislation dealing with the legalization of marijuana so that home growers are not shut out of the system. Hey, Rick, thank you so much for joining Open Mic this morning.
Thank you, Mike.
That was Rick Vetch from the Vermont Homegrown organization. We'll be back in a minute. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In a moment, we'll speak with WCAX reporter Alex Apple, who's in South Carolina covering the South Carolina Democratic primary. On the line, joining us this morning is WCAX reporter Alex Apple, and he's in South Carolina. Alex, whereabouts in South Carolina are you?
Well, I'll tell you, we caught a little bit of an audible since I spoke with you yesterday. I'm actually going to do some reporting from Richmond, Virginia tonight. And the reason we're going to do that is because we're still headed to South Carolina, and ultimately our focus will be on covering the Democratic primary and how Bernie Sanders plays out with a different demographic down there in the South, but even beyond South Carolina. He has certainly started to look towards Super Tuesday and started to look at the states where he can strategically compete there. It's a tough demographic as you go through so-called the SEC primaries, a lot of southern states with a lot of diversity, Latino voters, African-American voters, that are going to play a role. We're going to first take a look at how they're already organizing in Virginia tonight. And then we will also be on to South Carolina later this week.
And what are you hearing? I mean, obviously, Sanders' campaign has to break into Hillary Clinton's sort of commanding lead in the African-American vote. How does he do that? What are you hearing from the campaign, if anything, at this moment?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm hearing right now from the candidate. And Bernie Sanders, he said this when I asked him about it 2 months ago. He said this when I asked him about it in Iowa. That as more African Americans start to hear my message, and he's talking about his message on income inequality, a broken criminal justice system, and a rigged campaign finance system, he believes as more African Americans hear that message, that they'll start to come around to his campaign. They'll open their minds, perhaps vote for him. And the question remains to be seen whether that's good enough for African-American voters. You know, with the Black Lives Matter movement, with a lot of the controversy surrounding episodes with police over the last 2 years, African-Americans are looking for someone that's going to talk to issues specific to them. You know, they want to hear about systemic racism. They want to hear about, you know, police brutality and how he feels like he could address that. And if he tailors his message to speak directly to them, as opposed to hoping that they come around to his economic message, I think that's when he's going to be most successful. But right now, what I'm hearing is simply just that he is hoping that they will come around to his economic message, and I haven't seen much of a change from him compared to what he normally said.
Obviously, the VPR poll shows that Bernie Sanders has a commanding lead here in Vermont, 83.1%. And if you look at the delegates, and I looked on your website today and found the CBS delegate count, which if you just look at the primary results, Clinton and Sanders are tied at 51%. But if you add in the superdelegates, Clinton has 451 to Sanders 19 for a total of 502 to 70. What's it look like for him in South Carolina? It seems like he has an uphill battle.
It seems like a win for him in South Carolina would almost be staying within 10 points. So let's just say, let me give you a hypothetical here. Hypothetically, if he loses every state the rest of the way out and he loses by a margin of 55 to 45, Hillary Clinton does not get to the number of delegates needed to secure the Democratic nomination. She would have to rely on superdelegates to push her over that level. No candidate wants that. No member of the DNC wants that. That's not the scenario they want to play out. If you're Bernie Sanders and you start to look at the math, it becomes very difficult. Because at some point, close simply isn't good enough. You got to start to win some states. He's looking at the following, I think. He's looking at Oklahoma, Minnesota, Michigan, Massachusetts is a Super Tuesday state. Colorado is one. He feels like he can compete at, and what's the common denominator? A largely white electorate in those states. And that's where he feels like he can compete right now. And so he's going to try to chip into her lead in those states as she looks. Even further, perhaps it's Utah and Idaho, where polls show he is up big on Hillary Clinton, much like he was in New Hampshire. We did a story last week, and I was going to tweet a link to it again. I was actually doing that when I got the call from you all, that we took a look at if Hillary Clinton wins, let's say, 8 of the 11 Super Tuesday states, and she is pulling ahead at 8 of 11, how does the math go for Bernie Sanders from there? And we used our touch screen in our studio, and I thought it was interesting. I'll tweet another link to it, because there's a lot of ways where Hillary Clinton doesn't quite get to the number of delegates needed. Bernie Sanders' argument is, hey, you know, before the superdelegates get too far into this, take a step back. You don't have to necessarily endorse my campaign, but don't endorse Secretary Clinton yet either, and let's let this play out. You know, what we all know is that you hear every 4 years, oh, could there be a brokered convention, and it hasn't happened in 60 years. But I do know that nobody in the Democratic Party wants superdelegates to have to push one of these candidates over the finish line.
As you've mentioned, expectations are the game in presidential politics, and coming above expectations, particularly in South Carolina, would probably be a win for Bernie Sanders, how it's looked at nationally. Obviously, if you look at looking back at Nevada, it was interesting because a couple of months ago he was nowhere in sight in Nevada, and I kind of get the impression he let the expectation game get away from him, because towards the end the expectation was that he was going to beat Hillary Clinton, and even though he came close, it was sort of a letdown for the campaign, or so it seemed, because he didn't win that, and yet he came from almost zero up to 47%.
Yeah, and the folks that were reporting from Hillary Clinton's Brooklyn campaign headquarters were talking about how ecstatic the campaign was. You know, Hillary Clinton visibly excited in Las Vegas with her Nevada state director. I mean, and when she got up on stage, that excitement really came through in the speech. I mean, that was a strong speech. Hillary Clinton is probably becoming a stronger candidate as she's being challenged by Bernie Sanders. And I think you're right. Expectations got away from him, where people weren't talking about Bernie Sanders has come back 40 points down. Look, he might win Nevada. It was Bernie Sanders is going to win Nevada. And Bernie Sanders should win Nevada. And so by framing not the argument about a big comeback, but rather that he should have won,
I think you're right. Expectations got away from him. But if we're looking at this, that's a state he needs to win. You know, where he's close, he needs to exceed expectations, because there's a lot of states simply set up better for Hillary Clinton's coalition at this time. So Nevada is the kind of state where you've seen it now twice, in Iowa and Nevada. He's been close, but his campaign's been out-organized.
One of
the campaign has gotten their voters to the polls a little bit more.
One of the things that there seems to be an argument over is who got the Latino vote in Nevada. The Sanders campaign is saying they did. The Clinton campaign is disputing that. But there is, on Super Tuesday, Texas is one of those states, a huge Latino vote. What's it look like for Sanders in Texas, for example?
It looks like Hillary Clinton is probably going to win in that state. But that's one of those states where, you know, if Bernie Sanders were to pluck off one of the big delegate states, Tennessee, Texas, Georgia, on Super Tuesday, big win for him. And that's really where the narrative of this race could flip again, and where he could put some pressure on Hillary Clinton again. So he's got to win one of those if he really wants to put pressure on her. But it's really important, if you're talking long-term staying power, and just by virtue of him being able to extend this race, keeping it going, he's got to be really close in Texas. And so it's going to require some African-American Latinos to vote for him, and what proportion they turn out for him on voting day is ultimately going to be the big story. If there is not a warming up to his message from those minority groups, it's very, very difficult to see a plausible scenario where he can keep this campaign going long term, you know, and give himself a chance as it gets into the more favorable northern states as the calendar turns to.
South Carolina is when, the primary?
South Carolina is Saturday.
And what will you be looking for when you go down there in South Carolina in terms of trying to gauge what is going on?
One of the things that we're going to try to show our viewers is exactly why South Carolina is demographically, socially, and politically different than Vermont. You know, if you're on the ground in Vermont, you know Bernie Sanders for years, and you know how people have warmed up to him and received his message. And so I've had some Vermonters ask me, you know, why is it that people in South Carolina are not more receptive to that message? We're going to try to answer that question. We're also going to take a look at, you know, whether he is making inroads with the African-American and Latino communities. When he appeared at a church last weekend, I think a lot of people in the room felt the reception. It was a largely black church. Well, the reception was pretty tepid. And so I'm going to talk to some voters, and we really want to try to find out what it is about his message that is working and what else they want to hear from him, because he's largely unknown and his rise is in many ways improbable. So how well he's able to take the connection besides the political outsider offering a fresh economic message and a fresh economic agenda will ultimately depend on, or may ultimately make the difference of how he's going to do. He's got to resonate on something other than just the economy, because like Hillary Clinton's been attacking him for, she said he's a one-issue candidate, and perhaps some voters in South Carolina feel that's true.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for your time. That's Alex Apple, WCAX reporter, will be reporting tonight from Richmond, Virginia. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. Where did the time go? It is amazing how fast the time went today. Tomorrow, a discussion about the FBI and Apple. We'll open up the program. We'll talk with Alan Gilbert of ACLU. And Tom, what do we have for time left? We have 30 seconds, so we'll see you tomorrow. This is Open Mic on WDEV Radio AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barry, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll talk again tomorrow.